Yes, but before I begin, there's a special announcement, and I defer to someone much lovelier than myself.
No. Tonight there's Kaylee, here in the tea room. You need tickets, and for the tickets, you just come to me or to Lorraine. Stand up,
yeah?
Or to Lorraine.
We're
going to do something. So I just wanted to announce it, let you know about it. There's going to be a caller is coming in. He's coming in with a cordial. So it's going to be a good evening.
So please come. Even though I did nothing to do with it, actually working on it at all.
I encourage you to attend. Unfortunately, my dancing days are over. They never lasted very long. I certainly could watch. I'm a little tempted because the accordion is going to be here. I grew up in Wisconsin, in the Midwest, with many Polish neighborhoods. So there was a lot of polka music, and much of it accompanied by accordion. One of my favorite old jokes, and this goes way back, do you know the patron saint of accordionists? Our Lady of Spain. Now, see, you're not American, so you don't get the joke. It's a tune played by every American accordion player, is Lady of Spain. So when one has to explain a joke, it's not a good thing, I guarantee you. Not good at all. I said yesterday, and it turned out indeed to be the case, and I'm glad that I was saying to someone earlier, one of the best parts of teaching is it's the way you learn things. And I was informed that the father of Richard II was not killed in battle. I had assumed that he was. He, in fact, sacked Limoges during one of the battles in the Hundred Years' War and became very seriously ill physically and died in France and then, in England. See, it's good. But his eldest son, who was another Edward, died before he could assume the throne. So Richard was really the second son. So his father, who would have been king, died. The elder son, who would have been king, died. So there may have been on Richard this sense of some sort of special protection, and that he indeed was the one meant to assume the throne. I'm going to make the case that even though Shakespeare wrote these plays over an extended period of time, he had much of it planned out or was looking forward when he began. He would have learned this from the success of the Henry VI plays, where since the first was so successful, he kept doing sequels and prequels, and as long as there was an audience willing to pay money to come and see the plays, he would keep writing them. So I'm assuming when he wrote Richard II, he had something in mind of keeping the story moving forward. And as a little bit of proof, there is a very brief speech at the end of Richard II. It's the newly crowned Henry IV, who at the opening of Act 5, Scene 3, is speaking to those his advisors around him and says, "Can no man tell me of my unthrifty son? 'Tis full 3 months since I did see him last. If any plague hang over us, 'tis he. I would to God, my lords, he might be found. Inquire at London amongst the taverns there, for there, they say, he daily doth frequent with unrestrained loose companions, even such, they say, as stand in narrow lanes and beat our watch and rob our passengers, while he, young wanton and effeminate boy, takes on the point of honor to support so dissolute a crew." Very unhappy about the young prince, Prince Hal, who will become Henry V. But there at the end of Richard II, Shakespeare is already looking forward, I think, to what he will do in the three plays I will talk about, two of them today, both parts of Henry IV and then Henry V tomorrow. Now, the two plays today are called Henry IV Parts 1 and 2. That's because Henry IV is the reigning king, and Shakespeare names the plays for the king, but the plays are not about King Henry. He is there. He's important. But he is a supporting character, and the leading character in both plays is Prince Hal, the future Henry V. I'm going to discuss these two plays this afternoon as two different versions of what you might think of as a longer play called The Education of a Prince. And that is, if you're going to have a young man who's going to be king, who is aware that he's going to be king, what essentials must he have in order to be a worthy king? And in these two parts, what Shakespeare does is present two different aspects of the necessary education of a prince. And they are very different plays because they are dealing with very different types of schooling and very different subjects that must be learned. But I do think, in a way, we could say that these plays, Prince Hal Part 1, Prince Hal Part 2, followed by Henry V. This is the figure that we're following. Now, it's very interesting. Let me just say, Henry IV Part 1 is one of the greatest dramas ever written by anybody. It is one of Shakespeare's absolute masterpieces. It has, from its first appearance, held the stage constantly. Actors love it. Audiences love it. It is an absolutely superb piece of dramaturgy. And because of the brilliant structure and the brilliant characters and the shaping of the action of the play, the great poetry, the fascinating humor, the variety of incidents, it is theatrical in a way that Shakespeare's very best plays are. This is wonderful. Part two will be very different. It may be part two, but it's an entirely different world we enter in Henry IV, part two. There are four great acting roles for actors. Henry IV is a fine role. It may be the toughest of them. He only appears occasionally, and he is less flamboyant than any of the other actors. Prince Hal, a great role. As I said, really the center of the play. Young Harry Hotspur, Henry Percy. Heir to the Northumberland family who assisted Henry Bolingbroke to become Henry IV, and now the family is turning on him. They saw to it that he gained the throne. They expected certain things from him. Their expectations have been disappointed, and now they are beginning to turn on him. Okay, and indeed, the Northumberlands will become the rebel band that eventually turns on him in this play, led by this extraordinary young figure, heroic figure, and very interesting young man named Hotspur. That's his nickname. Harry Percy, as he's known. And then finally, as I said, one of the greatest creations of all time. Where he came from, we don't know for certain. Some believe that his original name in an earlier version of the play was called Sir John Oldcastle, a noted Puritan from Shakespeare's own time. The Oldcastle family was outraged, and Shakespeare changed the name to Sir John Falstaff. And Falstaff is, simply put, one of the handful of greatest comic characters ever conceived by anyone. I have a short list of three great comic characters: Sir John Falstaff, Don Quixote, and Mr. Micawber and David Copperfield. To me, they're the three incomparable comic characters, and if you put them together, you have this enormous package of human failing that is easily forgivable because these characters are so lovable. And if indeed part of what comedy does is remind us of our common humanity, then these characters do that. I'll say more of that in just a moment. Now, it's very interesting. One reason this play is done so often is you have great acting parts. These are roles that actors want to play. It's very interesting. Back in the 40s, when this play was being done at the Old Vic, Sir Laurence Olivier was given his choice of characters and chose to play Hotspur. And his Hotspur apparently was definitive. You can read about it. It sounds absolutely brilliant. Perhaps the greatest Falstaff of recent times, Sir Ralph Richardson, a legendary performance in both parts. And again, it's a shame we can't see these performances, but we have records of them. And let me recommend, as I said before, the BBC series of all of these plays, Richard II, both parts of Henry IV, Henry V, done in the late 70s, are quite good. Not perfect, they've got some flaws, but they're very good and worth seeing. Sir Anthony Quayle plays Falstaff and is delightful. But let me also recommend, if you can find it, There is a superb film of the two parts of Henry IV, done by the brilliant filmmaker Orson Welles, who unfortunately never got the career he deserved because, as you know, in his first film, he made an enemy of William Randolph Hearst, Citizen Kane. And Welles' directing career never took off. Hollywood ignored him. For the rest of his days, he had to put together films piecemeal, raising a little money, shooting a little film, trying to raise more money, going off to act in some dreadful movie and taking the salary. Well, he did a film called Chimes at Midnight, sometimes called simply Falstaff. It's magnificent. The sound is terrible because he could never afford to have a sound man on the set. Much of it was dubbed later. You have to put up with bad sound. The filming is magnificent. John Gielgud plays Henry IV. It's magnificent. And Welles himself plays Falstaff. So he directs and gives a stunning performance. And if you ever get a chance, by all means, check that out. Now, let me give you a little schema, if you will, as to how to look at the play. And I think this will help you understand why structurally this play is so brilliant and works so well on stage. In Henry IV, Part One, Shakespeare creates three different worlds. There is not just one world to this play. Henry IV, Part One is a play that exists in three different spaces, if you will, three self-contained worlds that are unique, each one absolutely unique, and each one ruled over by a figure that dominates that world. The first and most obvious, and this is where the play begins, is the world of politics. It's the world of the court, dominated, obviously, by King Henry IV himself. The world of politics, as was the case with Henry Bolingbroke in Richard II, is dry, practical, Machiavellian, day-to-day problems of sustaining power, fighting off enemies, and the world of the court is an interesting place, but mainly interesting for those who have an obsessive interest in politics. It is not a place of light, air, and life. That we get in the second world, and indeed in each of the first three scenes of the play, Shakespeare introduces the three worlds. We begin at the court with Henry. We go to the world of the tavern. And it's very clear why the young prince has abandoned the court and is spending his time in the tavern. And obviously, the world of the tavern is dominated by this figure, Sir John Falstaff. It is a place of wine, women, song, laughter, joy, delight, wit. It is, if you will, filled, permeated with the kind of life that is absent from the political world of the court. And it is not surprising that the young prince has abandoned the court and gone to a world in which, as a youth, he can feel or give expression to the kind of youthful energy that fills him as a young man. Now, in scene three, we meet the third character. We don't actually go to his world until later in the play, but that world is looming through the whole play. It's the world of the battlefield. And the figure that dominates the battlefield is Hotspur, young Harry Percy, who is also, again, vibrant, alive, filled with life. He has sides to him that one only finds occasionally in the great warrior. He is very witty. He is very witty. He has a comic sense of his own. He has a poetic nature. His use of language is brilliant, and he's able to use words in a way that the king can't, which is why when they have confrontations, the king is particularly irritated, because here is this younger man who has a vocabulary and an imagination at his disposal that the king himself doesn't. Hotspur dominates the battlefield, and the play is moving toward that moment where all the characters, all the worlds, converge on the battlefield, and the final conflicts will have to be resolved, and that's Hotspur's world. Now, there is only one character in the play who moves among these worlds, and that's Prince Hal. Trying to find, if you will, who he is, define himself, understand himself, come to understand the England in which he lives, which he will one day govern, and he needs to know that world not just from the world of politics, which has been the only world his father has really known, but also the world of the battlefield, because unless you're willing to fight and die for something, you cannot say you really believe in it. And that's going to happen during the course of this play. But also the lived life of the people that he will be out there governing, and that's the world of the tavern, the lower classes. Even though Sir John Falstaff did get a title at some point, we don't know how, we can't quite imagine how, but nevertheless, he's spending his time in the tavern world with those, with the lower classes, if you will. So, the other thing that is going on here is that Hal is looking for a father. It is indeed true, as King Henry IV has said, his son does not stay around the court. The lessons of politics are not being passed from father to son. But we do have a sense that he is searching for a father. And in Sir John Falstaff, he finds a surrogate father who teaches him lessons of life, lived life, in terms of how people actually live in the realm of England, very different from any lessons his father by blood could possibly teach him. And at least in this play, those attractions dominate. Now, one historical change that Shakespeare makes here, and it's a brilliant change, and makes the play work in a profound way. In historical fact, Hotspur, Harry Percy, who was the leader of the Northumberlands against King Henry IV, was older than Henry IV himself. He was older than the king. What Shakespeare does is take about 30 years off his life. So he becomes a young man, and we have the battle of the two young men, Prince Hal and Hotspur. So we get a sense, not just of two young men who will have to eventually, we know it's going to happen, meet on that battlefield, but also the question of which vision is going to dominate in the future. Because whichever one of these young men wins, that will be, if you can put it this way or think of it this way, that will be the future of England. That will be the future of the country. And therefore, he makes them the same age. The other's change is there is no record that they actually met one-on-one in that final duel to the death. It's great theater. It had to happen that way. So, of course, he makes that change. We're waiting all five acts for the two to confront each other. And, indeed, at the end of the play, they finally do. And it's a battle to the death, as it should be. It's great theater. We understand why he made that change. But it's also in line very much with the themes of the play. Now, let me start very first scene. King Henry is still very much the man we met in Richard II, but there has been some change in him. He is carrying a burden of guilt, and guilt humanizes any character, any human being. The measure of guilt is small, but he gives expression to it, and the guilt is for two separate things. One, his murder of Richard, which will hang over him until the moment of his death. And number two, the fact that his belief that his taking the crown would finally settle the political affairs of England has proven to be unfounded. In fact, what has happened is that more civil unrest has broken out. And he is facing not only the troubles in Ireland that Richard tried to quell, he's facing a rebellion in Scotland. He's facing a rebellion in Wales, and now it looks as if he's facing internal rebellion from the Northumberland family within England itself. He has tried to put down the Irish rebellion. he has sent Harry Hotspur to go to Scotland to put down that rebellion, and word has come that that rebellion has indeed been quelled for the moment. He has sent off to Wales to fight the great Welsh chieftain Owen Glendower, a young man named Edmund Mortimer. Edmund Mortimer was named by Richard as heir to the throne before Richard died. So if there is a legitimate heir hanging around, it's Edmund Mortimer. So Henry sends him off to Wales. If he wins, it's great. He's quelled the Welsh rebellion. If he loses and is killed, it's great. The heir named by Richard is out of the way. So it appears to be a no-lose situation for Henry. And then word comes, Edmund Mortimer lost, he wasn't killed, and he married Glendower's daughter. So the troubles are multiplying. And then word comes, Hotspur beat the Scottish rebels, but refuses to hand over the prisoners to the king. Rebellion, trouble everywhere. The irony is, Henry opens the play by saying that all troubles are over. The civil disturbances have stopped. It's a wonderful speech. I'll just give you a piece of it. No more the thirsty entrance of this soil shall daub her lips with her own children's blood. No more shall trenching war channel her fields, nor bruise her flowerets with the armed hoofs of hostile paces. Those opposed eyes, which, like the meteors of a troubled heaven, all of one nature, of one substance bred, did lately meet in the intestine shock and furious close of civil butchery, shall now in mutual well-beseeming ranks march all one way and be no more opposed against acquaintance, kindred, and allies. The edge of war, like an ill-sheathed knife, no more shall cut his master. It's the most poetic Henry ever gets, really. It's quite good. And then he announces his intention. Therefore, friends, as far as to the sepulchre of Christ, whose soldier now, under whose blessed cross, we are impressed and engaged to fight, forthwith the power of England shall we levy, whose arms were molded in their mother's womb, to chase those pagans in those holy fields, over whose acres walked those blessed feet, which 1400 years ago were nailed for our advantage on the bitter cross. He's going to the Crusades. He's going to the Holy Land. Part of it, in order to give thanks for peace at home, also out of his own sense of guilt for what he did to Richard. He finishes the speech and word comes from Wales, from Scotland, and it can't happen. It can't be done. Things change instantly. He is most upset, however, in learning of the great victory of Hotspur on the field in Scotland. He in fact says, "Thou makest me sad and makest me sin and envy, that my lord Northumberland should be the father to so blessed a son who is the theme of honor's tongue, amongst a grove, the very straightest plant, who is sweet fortune's minion and her pride, whilst I, by looking on the praise of him, see riot and dishonor stain the brow of my young Harry. Oh, that it could be proved that some night-tripping fairy had exchanged in cradle clothes our children where they lay and called mine Percy, his Plantagenet, then would I have his Harry and he mine." Tough words from a father about his own son. Whew. We move immediately to the next scene where we meet Prince Hal, who's not been anywhere near a battlefield, who's not taking any part whatsoever in the negotiations in the court or looking at what's happening politically. We meet him as he wakes up a snoring Falstaff, who obviously has been asleep from excess of liquid refreshment. Now, I'm going to pause here for a moment. Falstaff enters English literature, well, world literature, with a wonderful line that gives definition to his character, but also tells us something about the history plays that I'm looking at. Falstaff awakens, turns to Prince Hal, and says, "Now, Hal, what time of day is it, lad?" Falstaff exists outside of time. When he wakes up, he doesn't know if it's morning, afternoon, night, or the middle of the night. Time has no connection over him. The first line of Richard II, where we began yesterday, is Richard turning to old John of Gaunt and saying, "Old John of Gaunt, time-honored Lancaster." And Richard II has ended the last line of Henry the spoken by the newly crowned Henry IV by saying, "Grace my mornings here in weeping after this untimely bier." Poor Richard died too soon. The play begins with a time reference. The play ends with a time reference. History is time. What Shakespeare is examining in the history plays is the effect of events in time on human character and the movements of peoples. And history is subject to time. Later this afternoon, I'll look at a particular speech from Henry IV, Part 2, that deals this. We finally get to it in a core moment where Shakespeare looks at his vision of history. But it is time-dominated. In the midst of these time-dominated history plays, Sir John Falstaff wakes up and says, "Now, Hal, what time of day is it, lad?" He's free of time. He doesn't care about history or politics or wars or what's going to happen tomorrow or what happened yesterday. All he wonders is who's going to bring him his next cup of sack. Now, the prince's response shows us the intelligence and the wit of this young man who hasn't been at court. He's been hanging around with Falstaff. "Thou art so fat-witted with drinking of old sack and unbuttoning thee after supper and sleeping upon benches after noon that thou hast forgotten to demand that truly which thou wouldst truly know. What a devil hast thou to do with the time of day? Unless hours were cups of sack, and minutes capons, and clocks the tongues of bawds, and dials the signs of leaping houses, and the blessed sun himself a fair hot wench in flame-colored taffeta, I see no reason why thou shouldst be so superfluous as to demand the time of day." Just magnificent. Just magnificent. But one reason Hal wants to be in that world and learn from this surrogate father is that time and history and events are pressing on him. They're there. He will not escape them forever, and he knows it. Indeed, the scene ends with Hal giving a soliloquy that has been much commented on, where he talks about these friends he's made and this world he's living in, fully knowing where he should be and what he should be doing. "I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humor of your idleness. Yet herein will I imitate the sun, who doth permit the base contagious clouds to smother up his beauty from the world, that when he please again to be himself, being wanted, he may be more wondered at, by breaking through the foul and ugly mists of vapors that did seem to strangle him." Notice the imagery comes from Richard. I'm going to be like the sun. And right now the clouds are covering me, but the moment will come, I will burst forth in all my glory. Now, this isn't mentioned in the play, but it's a historical fact. Young Prince Hal was a page boy in Richard's court. In some ways, he spent more time around Richard than he spent around his own father. And there are aspects of Richard that have entered him. He goes on in the speech to basically say he will throw off this loose behavior and pay the debt I never promised. "By how much better than my words I am, and by so much shall I falsify men's hopes. And like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. I'll so offend to make offense a skill, redeeming time when men think least I will. I'm doing this now. Nobody understands me. But boy, in the future, am I going to come shining through. And I'm going to prove what a good guy I am, and I'm going to reform, and when that happens, the whole world will be amazed and sing my praises. Many call him as Machiavellian as his father because of this speech. That the whole thing is planned out, the whole thing is arranged, I don't think it's quite true. Let me make a little defense of the young man here. We all know what it means to say we're going to reform at some point. We all, being human, know what it means to say, I'm going to start living a better life. I'm going to overcome this bad habit. For myself, at least two or three times a day, I'm convinced I'm going on a serious diet. And it's going to start tomorrow. It's going to begin tomorrow. And then suddenly, when I'm the new slimmed down version of Dr. White, the world will be amazed and say, how did you do that? Why, you look 30 years younger. Okay? And simultaneous, while I'm at it, I'll grow hair again, and the wrinkles will disappear. This is a game we all play. This young man, I think, is indeed playing that game, and indeed, he's learned it from his mentor and surrogate father, Sir John Falstaff, who throughout the entire play, both plays, in which he's a dominating figure, keeps talking about he's going to give this life o'er. I'm going to repent. I'm going to change my ways. I'm going to become a good, decent man and no longer do this. It's very, very funny. And indeed, in this very scene where we first meet him and he's bickering back and forth with Hal, he accuses the young man of having corrupted him. Oh, thou hast damnable iteration, and art indeed able to corrupt a saint. Thou hast done much harm upon me, Hal. God forgive thee for it. Before I knew thee, Hal, I knew nothing. And now am I, if a man should speak truly, little better than one of the wicked. I must give over this life, and I will give it over by the Lord, and I do not. I am a villain. I'll be damned for never a son's king in Christendom. He's heard this. He's learned it. It's part of the tavern game. Now, he will reform at the end. He will change his ways. At this point, I believe it's still part of the tavern game, a game he's learned to play with Falstaff. As Falstaff will say in Act 2, Scene 4 of the play, let me say a few words on behalf of this Falstaff. He says at one point, when he's about to defend himself, let me say a few words on behalf of this Sir John Falstaff. Why do we love this man? He's wretched. He's wretched. If you stood outside a confessional and made a list of all the sins being confessed as sinners go into the confessional and pack them in one corpulent body, you'd have this man. By any standard of judgment, he's loathsome. By any standard of morality, he should have been run out of town from the moment he first appeared. In terms of literature, the plays should be banned. No young person should ever be allowed to read the play or see the play. He is a wretched, disgraceful, disgusting, gluttonous, lying, alcoholic, womanizing, cowardly, offensive, prideful, slothful. Every possible vice has been packed into this man, and we love him. This, on Shakespeare's part, is almost unbelievable. How does he do it? By adding one element, one very simple element. There is one time in our life when we are a body, a bulk, a little package of desire, human desire, and get what we want instantly. And that's when we are children. I cry, I get fed. I poop, I get cleaned. I yell, I get attention. Children can get away with anything. Why? Because there's this innocence about them that make them so lovable that we'll put up with the crying and the dirty diapers and the constant feeding because they're wonderful. Indeed, as children get a little older, we can even put up with some of the lies they tell. Because children are so quick, are so witty, are so able to come up with excuses that even as we punish them and tell them that they've been very naughty and they can't lie anymore, we're biting the inside of our cheek because we want to laugh. Falstaff is the biggest baby who never grew up. And he has about him, thanks to Shakespeare, the air of a child. He is indeed living outside of time. In a curious way, the other Shakespeare character most like Falstaff, and he won't create this character for another 10 years, is Cleopatra. Time cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety. There is something of the same kind of dynamic energy and unmistakable complexity in that character as well. These characters are just one of a kind. Falstaff is a big baby, and we're willing to forgive him anything, because he makes us laugh. And the wit covers a world of faults. And no one is more aware of his own faults than he himself. He talks about them constantly. He refers to them constantly. He denies them constantly. He is always this close to reforming and becoming that better man. And we know it's not true. But we smile because the way he says it is so witty. I've got to tell you, this is maybe my favorite commercial I ever saw. And it didn't work because I don't remember the product. So it can't be a good commercial. I have no idea what the product was. But a mother walks into her daughter's little playroom, and the daughter is sitting in front of this beautiful, elaborate dollhouse, this huge dollhouse that looks as if an elephant just stepped on it. It's been crushed flat through the top, and the sides are falling apart, and the little girl's just sitting there looking at this ruined dollhouse. And the mother screams, "Susie, what happened to your dollhouse?" The little girl looks up at her and says, "Nothing." What, I guess it just imploded on its own. But the sheer innocence and the quickness of the response is Falstaffian. Now, I'm going to look at one of the great moments. Jumping ahead a little bit, I'll come back to Hotspur in just a moment. I'm still world of politics, world of the tavern. I'm in the world of the tavern. I seem to like to linger there. I'm in the world of the tavern, okay? What they plan in this first scene is a robbery. It's exactly what the king was complaining of. My son is joining robbers and robbing people on the road. This is terrible. And it is terrible. So they hear of the prince and his friend Poins plan with Falstaff. There are some pilgrims that are coming along the road. It's at Gad's Hill. They're going to have money, so we'll go and rob them. Falstaff agrees to join them, and then Poins comes up with the idea that he and the prince will then rob Falstaff and the other men. It'll turn into a double robbery. Falstaff and Bardolph and Peto will rob the pilgrims, and then the prince and Poins will rob Falstaff, and the joke will be when he gets back to the tavern, the lies he will tell about what happened and why he doesn't have the money. Whole thing is a setup. Now, I need to point out, it's one of the great comic scenes in all literature, but I need to point out, this is Shakespeare's genius, because what he is doing is giving us a comic subplot that mirrors the main action of the play. Shakespeare never wastes his comic scenes. All comic subplots in Shakespeare are echoing, reinforcing, commenting upon the main action. What's going on in the main action? Henry IV has robbed the crown from Richard II, and now rebels are trying to rob the crown from Henry IV. What we have going on in the play is there has been a major robbery, and now new robbers are trying to rob the original robber. It's exactly the same plot being carried out in the comic low-life characters, okay? So there's a very real reason for it being there. It's still very funny. We first get the robbery. Falstaff shows up, and they steal his horse, meaning that he has to walk a long distance. He's just screaming because if I travel but 4 foot by the squire further afoot, I shall break wind. Well, I doubt not but to die a fair death for all this. If I escape hanging for killing that rogue, I have forsworn his company hourly any time this 22 years, and yet I am bewitched with the rogue's company. If the rascal have not given me medicines to make me love him, I'll be hanged. It could not be else. I have drunk medicines. It's the only reason he puts up with the young prince. It's like the love potion from Tristan and Isolde. He can't help himself. He drank medicines. He is told by the prince to lay down and put his ear to the ground to see if he can hear the travelers approaching. He says, "Have you any levers to lift me up again, being down? It's blood. I'll not bear my own flesh so far afoot again for all the coin in thy king's exchequer." It's just wonderful. Just wonderful. Well, he robs the travelers, and then Prince and Poins come and rob him. And, of course, he goes screaming off as soon as they attack. The prince says Falstaff sweats to death and lards the lean earth as he walks along. It's a wonderful image. They go back to the tavern, and indeed, it's one of the great scenes in all of world literature. Now, it opens with a little comic moment again. Wonderful comic moment. They're waiting for Falstaff and the others to show up. And the prince decides to play a trick on poor young Francis, who's the drawer, who pours the cups of sack in the tavern. Sack, as you know, is just sherry. Okay. It was very popular then. It's what they drank in the taverns most of the time. So Poins goes in another room and is yelling for Francis. Basically, Francis, service, service, serving boy, serving boy. Meanwhile, the prince is holding him in this room, and he's talking to the Prince of Wales. So his job is to go serve others. But if the prince is there talking to you, you can't just run off on the prince. So you've got this poor young kid standing, torn between two obligations. The call for service and the prince who's demanding his attention. And it's a little comic image of Prince Hal himself, who has an obligation that's calling him away, but he doesn't want to leave conversation with those people that he's closest to and feels a real bond with, okay? Everything in this play, perfectly structured, brilliantly put together. Finally, Falstaff comes in, demands a cup of sack, swills it down, accuses them of adulterating it with lime. "You rogue, here's lime in this sack. There is nothing but roguery to be found in villainous man. Yet a coward is worse than a cup of sack with lime in it. A villainous coward." He believes the prince and Poins ran away before the robbery. "Go thy ways, old Jack. Die when thou wilt. If manhood, good manhood, be not forgot upon the face of the earth, then am I a shotten herring. There lives not three good men unhanged in England, and one of them is fat and grows old." What a bad world, I say. I would I were a weaver. I could sing psalms or anything. A plague of all cowards, I say. They be, well, why are you upset? Why are you upset? He says, you know, I call thee coward, I'll see thee damned ere I call thee coward, but I would give £1,000 I could run as fast as thou canst. You are straight enough in the shoulders. You care not who sees your back. Call you that backing of your friends? Okay, the prince Poins ran off. Then he tells the story of what happened. They were set upon. They robbed the travelers, and then they were set upon. And as he tells the story, first they're set upon by two, which is true, the prince and Poins. Then they're set upon, then the two turn into four, the four turn into seven, the seven turn into nine, the nine turn into 11, and as he tells the story, the battle becomes epic, grander, grander, fighting with more and more. He kills a couple of them, And then he shows his sword that has just been hacked to pieces. We found out later he takes his own dagger and hacks it to make it look as if he fought in a terrible battle. And the moment then comes when the prince turns on him and says, "We too saw you set on four and bound them and were masters of their wealth. Mark now how a plain tale shall put you down. Then did we too set on you four and with the word outface you from your prize? And Falstaff, you carried your guts away as nimbly with his quick dexterity and roared for mercy and still run and roared as ever I heard bull calf. What a slave art thou to hack thy sword as thou hast done and then say it was in fight. What trick, what device, what starting hole can thou now find out to hide thee from this open and apparent shame? Come, let's hear it, Jack. What trick hast thou now?" He's on the spot. "By the Lord, I knew ye as well as he that made ye. Why, here are you, my masters. Was it for me to kill the heir apparent? Should I turn upon the true prince? Why, thou knowest I am as valiant as Hercules, but beware instinct. The lion will not touch the true prince. Instinct is a great matter. I was now a coward on instinct." It's just brilliant. It's just absolutely brilliant. We love him. "I shall think the better of myself and thee during my life. I for a valiant lion, and thou for a true prince." And then he calls for a play. Let's have a play. Word has just come that Hal has to go to the court the next day and see his father. Accounting time has come. He's called in for an accounting. So Falstaff says, "I'll be your father, and you give the excuse you're going to give tomorrow when you have to go and appear before your father." So we set up the little play. Falstaff goes, they put a chair on one of the tables. He puts a cushion on his head as a crown. And then becomes the king and speaks with royal character and begins to accuse his son of thievery, hang around with bad company. He gives all of the accusations that are likely to hit the young man the next day, but just begins chronicling them when his theme changes and says, "Yet there is a virtuous man whom I have often noted in thy company." And it turns into self-praise. "But I know not his name. A goodly, portly man in faith, and a corpulent, of a cheerful look, a pleasing eye, and a most noble carriage, and as I think his age some 50, and everybody howls and shrieks, "Or by Our Lady inclining to 80, and now I remember me, his name is Falstaff. If that man should be lewdly given, he deceiveth me. For Harry, I see virtue in his looks." It's just outrageous. And Hal says, "Do you speak like my father? Step down, I'll be my father, you play me." And Falstaff's response, I absolutely love it, is, "Depose me? Oh, you're just like your father, deposing rightful kings." It's a wonderful joke. Right to the heart of the, "Depose me?" But they do it. They switch roles. Hal, having become his father, launches into an incredible verbal attack on the old man. "There is a devil haunts thee in the likeness of an old fat man. A ton of man is thy companion. Why dost thou converse with that trunk of humors, that bolting hutch of beastliness, that swollen parcel of dropsies, that huge bombard of sack, that stuffed cloak bag of guts, that roasted Manning tree ox with the pudding in his belly, that reverend vice, that gray iniquity, that father ruffian, that vanity in years? Wherein is he good but to taste sack and drink it? Wherein neat and cleanly but to carve a capon and eat it? Wherein cunning but in craft? Wherein crafty but in villainy? Wherein villainous but in all things? Wherein worthy but in nothing? I would your grace would take me with you. Who means your grace? That villainous, abominable misleader of youth, Falstaff, that old white-bearded Satan." The game has suddenly turned very serious. Only Shakespeare could turn on a dime like this. "My lord, the man I know." "I know thou dost. Now remember, Falstaff is acting Hal. But to say I know more harm in him than in myself were to say more that I know that he is old, the more the pity his white hairs do witness it. But that he is, saving your reverence, a whoremaster, that I utterly deny. If sack and sugar be a fault, God help the wicked. If to be old and merry be a sin, then many an old host I know is damned. If to be fat be to be hated, then Pharaoh's lean kine are to be loved. No, my good lord, banish Peto, banish Bardolph, banish Poins, but for sweet Jack Falstaff, kind Jack Falstaff, true Jack Falstaff, valiant Jack Falstaff, and therefore more valiant being as he is old Jack Falstaff. Time intrudes. Old Jack Falstaff. Banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish not him thy Harry's company. Banish plump Jack and banish all the world. Hal, playing king, looks at the old man and says four words. I do. I will. And then comes the knocking at the door, as in Macbeth. Shakespeare often, in moments of highest drama, will have the scene ended with a knocking at the door. We find out there what indeed is going to be the shape of the next play. But we move on here. And the word comes, the rebels are in arms. They're on the march. Hal has to go see his father. And we're moving towards that battlefield. We're moving towards that battlefield. Now, I've neglected Hotspur. A few words about Hotspur, because his moment is coming. Shakespeare makes him young, dynamic, energetic, self-sacrificing, heroic. What is it that Hal has to learn here? This is the education of a warrior. A great king must be a great warrior. He's got to know the battlefield. He has to be courageous. He has to be prepared to lay down his life on the battlefield. He's got to fight for what is right, good, true, and just. And there's Hotspur already formed, ready to do it. And has proven himself already by fighting for the king and putting down the Scottish rebellion, but not turning over the prisoners because his family is feuding with Henry. Internal tensions. He makes an excuse for not having turned over the prisoners. I got to do this. It's a great speech. My liege, I did deny no prisoners, but I remember when the fight was done, when I was dry with rage and extreme toil, breathless and faint, leaning upon my sword. It's Act 1, Scene 3. Came there a certain lord, neat and trimly dressed, fresh as a bridegroom, and his chin new reap showed like a stubble land at harvest home. From the court comes a courtier who didn't fight, nicely dressed, cleanly shaved, all the right courtly clothes. He was perfumed like a milliner, and twixt his finger and his thumb he held a poncet box, which ever and anon he gave his nose and took it away again, who therewith angry when next came there, took it in snuff. It's you. It's a wonderful scene. And still he smiled and talked, and as the soldiers bore dead bodies by, he called them untaught knaves, unmannerly, to bring a slovenly, unhandsome corpse betwixt the wind and his nobility. Oh, those bodies are smelling. Oh, don't walk, don't carry them by. Oh, achoo. But notice the image Hotspur is giving of the court. This is Henry's court. This is the messenger you send to me after I fought for you, defended you, put down the rebellion, put my life on the line, killed men. And this is what you send to me saying, now you turn over your prisoners to me? I won't go on. It's magnificent. But please notice Hotspur's wit, his use of language, his ability to get at the king without attacking him directly. And my goodness, it comes to real crisis, okay? And Hotspur and the Northumberland support the claim of young Edmund Mortimer, who's in Wales. They're going to Wales, so they will now join up with Owen Glendower and the Welsh rebels, and Hotspur takes with him the best of the Scottish fighters, the Earl of Douglas, among others. There's a real rebellion here, a real rebellion. Now, Hotspur, being a Shakespearean character, i.e. being like all Shakespeare characters, that is human, has a weakness. And his weakness is he's a glutton for honor. He is one of those gung-ho warriors that is so gung-ho, all he thinks about is fighting the battlefield, winning more honor. Just one little speech. This is magnificent. By heaven, methink it were an easy leap to pluck bright honor from the pale-faced moon, or dive into the bottom of the deep, and where fathom line could never touch the ground, and pluck up drowned honor by the locks, so he that doth redeem her thence might wear without carrival all her dignities. I'd go to the moon and bring honor back. I'd dive into the deep and bring honor up. Extremes. Total extremes, and this is the young man. Not balanced. Not balanced. Thinking constantly in extremes. And he won't listen to his own father and uncle as they try to calm him down. He is not called Hotspur for nothing. He becomes the head of the rebellion. We see him twice with his wife, Lady Hotspur. It is a wonderful marriage. It may be one of the most perfect marriages in Shakespeare. At the end of the comedies, we see really good marriages about to take place. But we don't go on to see the marriages. In this play, we see a couple who have been married, perfect for each other. He understands her, she understands him, they don't let the other get away with anything. There are little verbal battles, there's deep love. I won't go into it, but you should look closely at the depiction of that marriage. Energy, life, respect, needling, very interesting, but never beyond the bounds. It's a glorious marriage. Eventually his wife goes with him to Wales, and we're preparing for the big battle. The prince confronts his father, defends himself, and again as he defends himself, speaks in terms of redemption. God forgive them that have so much swayed your majesty's good thoughts away from me. I will redeem all this on Percy's head. And in the closing of some glorious day, be bold to tell you that I am your son. When I will wear a garment all of blood and stain my favors in a bloody mask, which washed away shall scour my shame with it. The admission of the need for redemption and redemption by blood, to wash the shame and sin away. And we are looking forward to that meeting on the battlefield. We know it's coming. The battle will be the great battle of Shrewsbury. And they all go marching off there. The rebels are camping near there. And then young Harry Percy, Hotspur, is betrayed by his own father, who had agreed to show up with a large number of troops and says, I'm sick, I can't come. And his uncle and the other advisors say, don't fight. We don't have enough troops. And he says, doesn't matter. I'm leading them. I can win this. Okay? A lack of self-knowledge or a sense of not having to share your honor and your victory with anyone else. He can do it. Falstaff, of course, is leading a troop of men. But those he was supposed to marshal to the field, he's allowed to pay him off. And he's just found pathetic creatures to drag with him as a substitute army. Hal comes upon him and says, where did you find these men? Where did they, these are your men? And Falstaff simply says of them, tut, 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 mortal men, mortal men, food for powder, food for powder. They'll fill a pit as well as better. Oh, they're just going to die anyway, so why waste the good men? I'll leave these folks in. It's just amazing, just amazing. We see him getting ready for the battlefield. The battle's about to take place. Hal says, I'll fight Hotspur one-on-one. Let's not have our armies die. Let's make it a one-to-one battle. And the king says, bring me your grievances. I will consider them. If they are valid, I will correct them. Hotspur's uncle goes back and lies and says there's no mercy in the king. And says, Hal offered to fight you one-on-one, but he's nothing. He's nothing. And the battle goes forward. Now, as soon as that happens, and we're heading into the battle, we get the opposite vision of honor. Falstaff's great honor speech, diametrically opposed to Hotspur's. Last time Falstaff talks to Prince Hal before the battle begins, Hal, if thou see me down in the battle and bestride me so, 'tis a point of friendship. If you see that I've fallen in the battle, stand over me with your sword and protect me. Prince says, nothing but a colossus can do thee that friendship. Say thy prayers and farewell. I would 'twere bedtime, Hal, and all well. Why, thou owest God a death. It's a wonderful line. The prince leaves. Falstaff says, 'tis not due yet. I would be loath to pay him before his day. What need I be so forward with him that calls not on me? Well, 'tis no matter. Honor pricks me on. Yea, but how if honor prick me off when I come on? How then? Can honor set to a leg? No. Or an arm? No. Or take away the grief of a wound? No. Honor hath no skill in surgery then? No. What is honor? A word. What is in that word honor? What is that honor? Air, a trim reckoning. Who hath it? He that died a Wednesday. Doth he feel it? No. Doth he hear it? No. 'Tis insensible then? Yea, to the dead. But will it not live with the living? No. Why? Detraction will not suffer it. Therefore, I'll none of it. Honor is a mere scutcheon, and so ends my catechism. Just by the way, please notice the attack on nominalism there. Honor is simply a word, it has no reality, therefore it doesn't really exist. Shakespeare gets a little dig in at the nominalists. He puts it in the mouth of Falstaff. Hardly a philosophical man whose opinions are to be trusted. And of course, what he's looking out for is to save his own skin. Now, we go into the battle. There we are, the battlefield. Hotspur rules. But please notice, and this is what is fascinating, it's not an old-fashioned American Western, which I love, by the way, with the good guys and the bad guys and the white hats and the black hats and the cowboys and the Indians. These are two young men, and we care for both of them. Neither one quite ready to meet the other in battle. One too full of himself, too proud, and too cocky and overconfident. The other untested, untried, full of promises, but not having prepared himself or really being ready to go out there. And needless to say, in the midst of the battle, where, one quick point, many are marching in the king's coats. At one point, they killed the king. It turns out to be somebody pretending to be the king. Because on the battlefield, you have many kings walking around, so nobody knows who the real king is. Well, it's another theme of the play. In this play, one of the problems is, who is the king? And how can we know? On the battlefield, the king hath many marching in his coats, we're told. In any case, Hal defends his father at one point. Hotspur comes upon Hal. They recognize each other. Hotspur says, if I mistake not, thou art Harry Monmouth. Thou speakest as if I would deny my name. My name is Harry Percy. Why then, I see a very valiant rebel of that name. Please notice, you're a rebel. You don't fight against the crown. You are a very valiant rebel. Respect for one's opponent as one heads into battle. Boy, that's forgotten today. A lot. Oh, dear. I am the Prince of Wales, and think not Percy to share with me in glory any more. Two stars keep not their motion in one sphere, nor can one England brook a double reign of Harry Percy and the Prince of Wales, nor shall it, Harry, for the hour has come to the end to end the one of us, and would to God your name and arms was now as great as mine. I'll make it greater ere I part from thee. And boom, they go at it. And in comes, of course, Falstaff, who becomes a cheerleader. Okay. Well said, Hal. True it, Hal. He's standing there pumping them on. When enter the Earl of Douglas, the greatest Scottish warrior, Falstaff turns around, and now he's confronted with a great fighter who begins wailing on him, and Falstaff takes his sword and pretends to have a heart attack. Ooh! And falls down dead. The Earl of Douglas stands there looking at this mountain of man and decides, well, he's dead already, and moves on. Whereupon Hal kills Hotspur. And indeed, Hotspur has a great death speech. I don't have the time right now to go through it. But the battle ends, Hal is won, Hotspur is dead, and Falstaff is dead. And Hal stands there between the two, and we have an Aristotelian moment. I would always use this moment to describe Aristotle's basic idea from the Ethics, that somehow one has to find the mean between two extremes. And Shakespeare designs it and puts it on the stage. On the one hand, vainglorious foolhardiness, a belief in oneself beyond anything reasonable, rational, or human. On the other hand, total cowardice, no sense that anything is worth fighting for. We have the two extremes, and there in the middle stands Hal between the two corpses. The mean between the two extremes. He says farewell to both of them. He does in two courtesies. Hotspur dies mid-speech. No, Percy, thou art dust and food for... And Hal finishes his sentence. For worms, brave Percy, compliments him. The young boy is showing his character. Fare thee well, great heart. Ill-weaved ambition, how much art thou shrunk. When this body did contain a spirit, a kingdom for it was too small a bound. But now 2 paces of the vilest earth is room enough. The earth that bears thee dead bears not alive so stout a gentleman. If thou wert sensible of courtesy, I should not make so dear a show of zeal. But let my favors hide thy mangled face. And he covers the dead boy's face with his handkerchief. It's a touching moment. Turns around and sees Falstaff. What? Old acquaintance. Could not all this flesh keep in a little life? Poor Jack, farewell. I could have better spared a better man. Oh, I should have a heavy miss of thee if I were much in love with vanity. Death hath not struck so fat a deer today. Though many dearer in this bloody fray, embowelled will I see thee by and by, till then in blood by noble Percy lie. He exits, and you cannot keep a good man down. Falstaff sits up and says, embowelled? If thou embowel me today, I'll give thee leave to powder me and eat me tomorrow. It's blood, 'twas time to counterfeit. Or that hot termagant Scot had paid me Scot and lot, too. Counterfeit? I lie. I am no counterfeit. To die is to be a counterfeit, for he is but the counterfeit of a man who hath not the life of a man. But to counterfeit dying, when a man thereby liveth, is to be no counterfeit, but the true and perfect image of life indeed. The better part of valor is discretion, in which better part I have saved my life. Zunes, I'm afraid of this gunpowder Percy, though he be dead. How if he should counterfeit too and rise? By my faith, I fear he would prove the better counterfeit. Therefore, I'll make him sure. And he stabs him in the thigh and claims he killed him. Hal walks in with his brother, Prince John, and there's the man. And Prince John says, did you not tell me this fat man was dead? The prince says, I did. I saw him dead, breathless and bleeding on the ground. Art thou alive, or is this a fantasy that plays upon our eyesights? Falstaff says, no, that's certain. I am not a double man. There is Percy. If your father will do me honor, so. If not, let him kill the next Percy himself. I look to be either earl or duke, I can assure you. Why, Percy, I killed myself and saw you dead. Didst thou? Lord, Lord, how this world is given to lying. I grant you I was down and out of breath, and so was he. But we rose both at an instant and fought a long hour by Shrewsbury clock. If I may believe so, if not, let them that should reward valor bear the sin upon their own hands. I'll take it upon my death. I gave him this wound in the thigh. If the man were alive and would deny it, Zunes would make him eat a piece of my sword. And Hal says, John says, this is the strangest tale that ever I heard. Prince Hal says, this is the strangest fellow, Brother John. Come, bear your luggage nobly on your back. For my part, if a lie may do thee grace, I'll gild it with the happiest terms I have. And Hal gives up credit for killing Hotspur. And it goes to Falstaff, who indeed, when we see him at the opening of part two, is ever increased in his nobility, his own self-respect, doing very well. The battle has been put down. Another front of the Civil War has ended, and the king declares victory. Wonderful final moment. The king ends the play. Rebellion in this land shall lose his sway, meeting the check of such another day. And since this business so fair is done, let us not leave till all our own be won. I've done this play twice. I've been very lucky. First time I played the evil Uncle Worcester, Hotspur's uncle. Second time, guess who I played? But first time I did it, the actor playing King Henry, who was a wonderful actor, one performance came to the end, the final two couplets, said the first couplet, and then we saw him, it's called drying, he went up. He could not remember the final couplet for the life of him. Stood there a bit, he raised his sword, and then he said, the war is over. And they brought the curtain in. So let me just say, the lecture is over.